Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at decodingtv.com. Become a paid member and get access to ad-free episodes as well as early access to episodes. Thanks so much to everyone at decodingtv.com who makes this podcast possible.
Everyone doubted me.
Well, why don't you just see your ideas in action, buddy? Watch. It's about to happen. Wait for it. Wait for it.
Oh, come on, man.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I'm David Chen, and I ask that you please not speak about your experience with this podcast. Joining me today is Patrick Klepek.
Who also saw a test turn positive this morning, but it wasn't a pregnancy test. His wife got COVID.
Oh, no. Oh, man. Yeah, well, Patrick's wife got COVID, but Patrick is still doing okay for now, and that's why he's here recording with us today to talk about The Curse, Episode 2, Pressure's Looking Good So Far. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com and find us across all platforms at decodingtv. Today, we're going to be discussing Episode 2 of The Curse. We're going to start by talking about some overall thoughts and then move on into a really detailed recap of the episode, break it down bit by bit for you. But before we do that, I do want to just read one comment. And arguably, this comment does have a spoiler in it for this episode, so just FYI. But David Potts wrote into decodingtv.com saying, quote, "I genuinely wonder if the show is foreshadowing Whitney getting impregnated by someone else, which I don't call cheating because I don't think her character would frame it that way, and I think Asher might even approve. My reasoning is because of the, quote, once you put sliced tomatoes between the bread, it's all the same. I immediately assumed with horror her dad was implying it doesn't matter who knocks up your wife as long as you all get to have a baby. While the rest of the scenes seemed to suggest this reading was way off, the following scenes brought this interpretation back into contention. First, the follow-up shot of Whitney pre-sex in the mirror felt like it was dripping with some weird tension. Maybe this is the couple's way of getting in the mood, but it made me wonder if Whitney is having the how the hell am I going to navigate these waters and get my parents off our back, etc., with someone who she realized may be incapable of meeting her sexual and impregnation needs. First time I've ever heard that phrase used, by the way, impregnation needs. Also, Dougie flirting with Whitney at the end seems like big time to swim the same direction. He's puffing her up in a way he knows will get through, and it seems like it may be effective based on her contemplative reaction. Finally, Asher's guilty face at the end could be read various ways, but in light of the pregnancy theory, what if he more or less realizes that Whitney may connect these dots herself as well, and given Asher knows Dougie's character, it's presented as if he may already suspect something may be in motion between the two," end quote. I'm going to say this. I don't think that's what Whitney's dad was referring to when she said, once you put the tomatoes between the bread, it's all the same, you know? But everything else about David's predictions do resonate with me now that I've seen this episode. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, I will say the response from Whitney when Dougie is like pumping her up, kind of flirting with her. There's not a lot of Whitney's not giving a lot of interest in a response. There definitely seems to be. It was definitely more of a deadpan, not quite horror, but just not really a response at all. Just, oh, this is a thing that's happening to me. And so I'm, I didn't really necessarily catch that Whitney was like on Dougie's vibe. In fact, that's many fair. Things that Dougie has done across the episode have made Whitney profoundly uncomfortable and upset. And I think much of the show is going to unpack how contradictory and hypocritical the values of Whitney are relative to how she acts and maybe truly feels. But I don't look, this show could get anywhere. She could have sex with Dougie and like, fine, sure, show continue. But I don't know that I caught a lot of sexual tension in the air between the two of them. But I do think the idea that Whitney is perhaps like seeking out solutions either to a problem presented by her parents. I don't know if her having a kid is necessary, not having a kid is necessarily what she views as a problem as much as when she has to resolve in the world around her. But I agree that sex and partners and relationships and masculinity is going to be a key topic that is unpacked as the season progresses.
Yeah. I mean, there's two things in favor of the Dougie theory, right? One is
the Dougie theory.
Well, one is that he's like pumping her up at the end there, and we know he kind of doesn't like her very much. So why would he mm-hmm. be doing that unless at the very least there was some interest on his side?
Well, I think Dougie might have an interest in any sandwich.
anything that David would
like to continue. Like,
I can't believe you used that phrase just now, but yeah. The other thing is. So it's revealed in this episode, like very first scene of this episode, that Whitney is pregnant. And I think it's heavily implied that the father is not Asher, Nathan Fielder's character.
Mm-hmm.
Who else could it be? There's no other characters really in the show that it could be is the problem. Like, I don't think there's enough other characters, right?
Dr. Brown?
Possibly. Dr. Brown, possibly Asher's friend at the casino.
The thing is, we know nothing about these characters on purpose, right? Like, so much of the show.
So it's like the only other character that would mean something is Dougie. That said, we're only two episodes into the show, and so it's like we might meet more people that will become significant later on. But the first person I thought of about who the father might be is Dougie. Because he's the only other character that has any characteristics at all in the show. So we'll see. We'll see. Anyway, interesting stuff that David Potts is picking up on there. And thanks for the comment over at decodingtv.com. All right, Patrick Klepek. Let's start and talk about episode 2 of The Curse. Specifically, Pressure's Looking Good So Far is the name of the episode, which I love. What did you think overall of The Curse episode 2?
I think it's great. I think it's fun to get out of the premise of the show and into the show itself. Like, okay, where are we going? Like, who are these characters? Like, what is going to motivate them going forward? And I think we get a lot of answers to those questions, or at least directions for these characters coming into this second episode. I've admittedly have not seen Nathan For You, but I've seen clips and some of these segments. There's a sequence in this episode that feels like it's just out of like a pseudo reality comedy show in a way that feels very in line with Fielder's work and could maybe appear in other work that he's done in the past. But this episode in general is like a real Fielder is present. Asher is present, but feels like a real showcase for Emma Stone and for Whitney. And I find myself just, captivated by this complete weirdo. Like, I cannot put a finger on who she is, like what her aims are. Like, I could describe characteristics of her perceived value structure, both externally and internally. And like, these layers, I think, are going to be, I don't think the answers are going to be comfortable, but I think they're going to be interesting. And I think the way they're setting up all these different characters by actually, I think this episode is successfully sets up Dougie as someone more interesting than just a weirdo villain foil for Asher and Whitney. Where that lands, I'm still not sure, because by the conclusion of this episode, it's not like it's setting up an arc for Dougie necessarily, but there's more to this character beyond the fears I had at the end of the first episode. Like, if all this character is a sketchy dude they shouldn't associate with and is going to sink whatever ambitions they have, and that becomes cartoonish over time, I don't necessarily know that this episode erased that as a concern, but the show is obviously aware, hey, we need to provide depth to these characters, especially in a show that has a growing cast of characters that come in and out. But in terms of the core group, like, there's three, and those three need to have some real depth to make sense. And I think a lot of what happens in this episode is furthering that depth. And I think broadly avoids also like some of the cringe worries that we had in the first episode of like, what is the style of comedy going to be here? Like, what is the lowbrow, highbrow stuff? Is the tiny dick going to be a joke that we're getting every single episode? And like, we're just going to keep hammering away at that. And I think those concerns are at least a little alleviated, or at least suggest the show has a broader palette to work with that I'm excited to see them like fully use going forward.
I agree on many counts of what you said. I thought this was an excellent episode. It continues the cringe comedy that we experienced in the first episode. I have a very odd experience watching the show because I am not using figurative exaggeration. Uh-huh. I literally curl up into like a fetal position watching the show because it's so painful. Meanwhile, my wife has no problem watching the show. I think, and we had the opposite reaction when we watched Nathan For You. I think because Nathan For You ostensibly involves real people. And in her mind, she's thinking, oh, all these people are fictional, so no, it doesn't matter what happens to them, right? Whereas for me, the feelings and sensations that this show evokes are so painful, you know, so excruciating that I can't help but have a physical reaction to it. So I agree with you on all counts, and I agree that Emma Stone is tremendous in this episode. Where I disagree with you is you saying you don't think you have that character pinned down. So far, I think it's pretty clear who that character is. She is a self-deluding, progressive, which is something we discussed last episode, right? Mm-hmm. Like this person who thinks they're extremely progressive in helping other people and doing their best and advocating for social justice causes, but are so clumsy at doing so that they accidentally stumble into a bunch of faux pas or terrible things that they're not supposed to do in that process. And honestly can occasionally actively cause damage in that process. Right. And so that kind of self-delusion that we got a taste of in episode one is continued in this episode. And I think is really sharp in its satire. It's very biting.
Yes. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, overall, also a huge fan of The Curse episode two.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
But Patrick, let's talk about some of the specific stuff that happened this episode. We open on a pregnancy test revealing that Whitney is presumably pregnant. So we are in full spoiler territory for episode two starting right now. And what an ominous shot. Like, it is an ultra close-up macro shot with this kind of sinister music in the background. Something that you said, Patrick, last episode that I think was really apt was one thing that one stylistic choice that the show makes is it will take a shot and hold on it for much longer than you are comfortable with. And that is, I think that's hugely influenced by a lot of Nathan Fielder's work on mm-hmm. Nathan For You. What he does is he'll put someone in an uncomfortable situation. And in a reality show, you typically just cut away from that, or it wouldn't even make the edit. But in Nathan For You, he'll hold on it and like let people sit with the awkwardness. Like, hey, hey, you just drank my piss, by the way, you'd see the person's like, what? And then cut away. But he'll just like sit for like the next 30 seconds and you wait to see how the reaction plays out, you know? And that's definitely a choice that they continue to make throughout this show and in this episode in particular.
To see that relative to the unpredictability of a controlled reality show, right? Like in which a lot of what my understanding of Nathan For You and like the rehearsal is like, you're setting up situations. So there's a controlled element, but then there's still a very human element of how will people respond, and that creates a bit of a chaotic element that is not present here, right? In which like that is happening
right.
on a script level, on like a yeah. planning level, on a choreography level, and so
right.
on an editing
right.
level, and they're thematically similar, but then can just be deployed in like wildly different ways that make for just, I mean, and it's also that often those long, like that long intro with the pregnancy test, this show also has a very low key distribution and use of music. There's just not a lot of it. And when it is used, it's very impactful. It's very meaningful. It's like really trying to underscore often the like tension or awkwardness of a scene, or the kind of ominous nature of yeah. a scene, or like what was great in the pilot. And I assume there'll be less of this as the show gets further and further away from the actual show that they're shooting, and more about like the plot that's carrying out like as a result of the shooting. But like, you know, you get moments where you get like the little jingle of like a reality show, like doon, doon, doon,
yeah.
doon, doon. And like, those are the two modes of composition that the music operates in. And it's just interesting to see how they're using all these different aesthetic elements
yeah.
really, really carefully. It is always feels like of the utmost deliberance in a way that when it is used, it's like, oh shit. Like if there's music present, like it feels like a character unto itself.
Yeah. Yeah. Deliberance, is that a word? Deliberation,
sure.
I think. Deliberation, I think.
You know what? Like
deliberateness.
Out here, like language is fluid. Language is changing. It's mm-hmm. an evolving cultural object,
yeah.
and so
language? What is language but a vessel for communicating what we are thinking? You know,
and
beyond that, there are no rules.
There are no rules.
Asher meets with the local TV reporter he's trying to dissuade from airing a disastrous interview, but the reporter doesn't think Asher is offering enough of a juicy story about his time at the casino. The reporter wants access to security tapes, and Asher claims to need more time. So he heads to the casino in question. You know, I just want to pause here and say, like, I really liked that Asher sets up very clearly via dialogue what he's trying to accomplish. He's like, I know what the folder is in the cloud. I just need to be able to access it. So he's like, oh, you just need to, like, log in and then like click and drag a thing to a thumb drive and then you're done. And so you kind of get a sense of what he's trying to accomplish even without any heist planning sequence. Anyway, Asher heads to the casino in question where he meets up with an old coworker and inspects some of the ideas he'd been working on while at the casino, including ceiling lighting that changes throughout the day to alter player moods and bracelets loaded with cash that allow players to sit at a slot machine for longer without having to walk to the ATM. Asher finds a way to get into the casino's security areas by asking to speak with another former coworker, but he's not in the office today, so Asher awkwardly leaves the casino. Let's pause here for a moment, Patrick. What did you think about this sequence? I thought that it was interesting to learn all the stuff that Asher worked on before, because basically mm-hmm. he's working on ways to exploit people at the casino, right? And that is very not in line with his whole image of helping people that he's trying to put out with his wife. In present day. So I do think it's just a symbol of how being part of any corporation in particular, an exploitative one like a casino, can often co-opt your efforts in a way that you didn't intend. But, you know, people just have to live with that cognitive dissonance a lot of the time. Any thoughts on, you know, learning about Asher's previous work?
Well, I think what's interesting is a lot of what the show has done so far with Whitney is underscore how she's a hypocrite and like living dual lives, one as performance and one as like what is your internal true self, as much as one can have something like that. Like, we don't know anything about Asher. We like he sits in the shadow of Whitney. Like mm-hmm. here, the show has a very telling moment where one of the most like common shots it's used is Asher reacting to something upsetting with sort of like this kind of zoom in shot on his face, in which there is a sense of despair or upset or disgust as it's like, it's either after like, you know, what happens with Whitney at the end of episode one, when they have the fight in the hallway and he tries to explain, you know, tracking down the girl that he took the money from. Here it's like, look at this elderly man being exploited. He doesn't have to get up to go to the ATM anymore. Like, he can just keep like sucking his like retirement savings away back into that slot machine that'll pay out just enough to psychologically hook him for a little bit more. And there's a sense that he understands there's something wrong about what he's done, but he doesn't vocalize it. He doesn't explain it. We don't get a sense of his, we have very little sense of his interiority.
I would argue the opposite. I'd say there's pride at what he's accomplished. Mm. Like he's very much like, hey, did you see the stuff that I helped to get done?
Yeah.
Like and you know, his coworker says, yeah, you know, you did great. Like that was a great thing for him. Which, by the way, side note, I recently watched this video on by NPR that was really interesting. It was the host of the video worked an entire day not getting up from her seat, and then worked an entire day getting up once every hour to like walk around for 5 minutes. And like her health indicators were way better on the days that, you know, she got up once every hour to like walk around, like blood pressure and stress levels and all this. Like it was all better if she got up and walked around every hour or so. So
it's why I've never turned off that little.
Yeah. Like, when your Apple Watch tells you to get up, hey, it has your best interests in mind. That's all I wanted
to
say.
You can turn that off, but I keep it on. I sometimes ignore it, but that is when I do. Well, like I'm recording, like, hey, David, I know that we're in the middle of talking about the curse, but like,
Siri's it does go off
me,
during
like,
podcasts quite a bit. Yeah, that's annoying.
But anyway, I use that throughout the day to like, oh, right, like I should go change the laundry. I get up for a couple of minutes. Like that's how I like do chore indicators is when it tells me to get up. And that's how I do little things around the house and like stretches my legs, like gets me to go up and down the stairs. Like if I don't actually work out that day, at least like I'm doing that. That does not shock me as being a good methodology to follow.
Love that. I think you're right that we don't really know that much about Asher until this episode. It seems like you thought his attitude was a little bit impenetrable. I thought it was clear that he was actually quite happy.
He takes pride in the work, but I just don't know what his value, like, you know what I mean? Like he takes pride in having done something well. And so
I don't sense
this
is a man who's tortured about it. I don't sense this is a man
probably
who's like,
not.
Think he's like really anguished about how he exploited all these people.
I just
want to
be clear what how he articulate, like whether the show will ever have him articulate.
Mm, yeah, sure.
That is a like Whitney articulates a philosophy, and then what's interesting is to watch that be undercut by her actions and deeds.
I think on some level, though, it doesn't really matter how he feels about it. Like the point is he partook in it and he had initiative. He wasn't just like a drone. He like tried to increase the conditions of exploitation. And I do think it's a statement about how many people who try to do good in the world often find themselves co-opted by forces beyond their control. Within their control.
Correct.
To some degree. And then they end up kind of going along.
Yeah, he's not just an employee at the casino because that's the only job he could get in town. And so, yes, I'm part of an exploitative structure, but also I've got to pay my rent and hopefully I can like balance that out in different ways in my life. This is like, you know what we need to do? Like get kids in the equation, you know?
Right.
So.
Right. So like maybe he's not happy with what he has to do. I doubt that. But even if that's the case, I don't think it really matters. Like he's still doing something terrible. Right. So anyway, Whitney meets with a local Pueblo tribe leader to talk about Asher and Whitney's work in respecting local communities, invites the leader to come to her friend's art show. Whitney's friend Kara is an indigenous artist, and she tries to explain how Kara and this leader are from the same background, only to be told that's not true. They speak a different language. Despite her mix up, the leader respects that Whitney cares and agrees to come to the show. So let's talk a little bit about, we can talk a little bit about Whitney and Asher and their dinner with Kara later, but I like this scene a lot because it's showing how Emma Stone is, you know, Whitney stumbling through all these things. But I particularly liked how Whitney, is my guess, instructed her assistants to take photos of them. And then she's like, hey, no, what are you doing? Stop taking photos. And then the guy's like, no, it's okay. You can take photos. And she's like, oh, really? Cool. You know, and I'm like, oh, wow, that's a great way of doing something that is kind of socially unacceptable is you tell someone else to do it. And then you like berate them so hard that the person you're with is like, no, actually, it's okay. They try to like stop you from being such a hard ass about it. I would never ever do anything like that, but I'm just saying, you know, wow, that's some good psychological warfare there, Whitney. Anyway, appreciate that.
Well, and it's interesting too, because there's like a couple different things happening there where she set that up with, you know, her assistant presumably, and then he offers to take a picture with his phone. She's like, no, like not on your phone. We can email it to you. Like,
yeah, yeah. Like, it's just she like planned it basically.
Correct. Like, no, this is a candid shot that is going to go on my Instagram profile.
Yeah.
Hashtag indigenous, like hashtag, like, right. You know, local communities later.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, they go to dinner. Whitney and Asher meet up with Kara for dinner. Whitney deletes some comments on her popular Instagram profile that claims she ripped off an artist with her house designs. They also discuss having Kara being a cultural consultant on the show. By the way, the name of the person that she ripped off is apparently a real life artist named Doug Aitken.
Oh, okay.
And if you Google Doug Aitken, you can see he has a house that looks identical to the house that Whitney and Asher built. And it's actually very funny that Whitney in the show says, oh yeah, it's different because I'm doing it in the middle of a town and he's doing it in the middle of the desert. But it's like this house looks like exactly the same, you know? So I thought that was a nice touch.
Desert X.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. That is one. That is just, yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. That is, yeah, you did rip that off, Whitney. Yeah.
You're one of the negative Nellies on Whitney's Instagram channel. And let me just throw this out there. If you are a Whitney, and you are having people, you know, comment negative things on your Instagram profile, I'm just going to throw this out there. Just shut down the comments on the post. You know, it's possible to post on Instagram and not allow comments. Whitney, you have better things to do with your time than deleting comments one by one. That's what I have to say about that. So,
but she wants the positive affirmation, right? I feel like that's going to be
so true.
Key to like how a character like that understands themselves. And it's tied up in performative progressivism is like, I do the good thing. I put the black square on my Instagram profile because, like, I respect Black Lives Matter and my voice shouldn't be heard. You know what I mean? Shit like that. Like, you don't turn off the comments because, like, you're right. Like, it's healthier to just, like, put your stuff out there and, like, have the commentary happen around it as opposed to underneath it. But for the character they're portraying, like, she cannot exist without, like, the social gratification.
Absolutely. I think definitely true. That's all correct. I would say it's a slippery slope from closely monitoring your Instagram comments to one day you're hiring an online anonymous troll army to harass TV critics like the the head of HBO recently did.
Yes.
Best to just step away from the social media when it comes to the negative comments. So anyway, at the dinner, Whitney waves off having the cultural consultant conversation, and instead, Kara and Whitney clash over people accusing Whitney of ripping off an artist online. Whitney tries to claim that artists can be inspired by other artists, which rubs Kara the wrong way. I think it also rubbed Kara the wrong way that Whitney thought of herself as an artist at all. You know,
yeah.
They also discover Kara is deeply uncomfortable with having her art featured in the staged homes they're building in the TV show. At which point they try to explain that's actually not happening, even though it clearly is. And Kara ends up having to leave due to a quote-unquote work emergency, at which point Whitney tries to brag about inviting the local Pueblo tribe leader to her art show, which clearly seems to make Kara upset. After Kara leaves, Whitney reveals she's pregnant. She's not very excited, but Asher very much is. Lot to unpack in that sequence. Patrick Lepik.
This might be... I feel like this is going to be a show that we look back on and... When we talk about the finale, we could probably do like, hey, each of us list like your top three favorite cringe moments like in the show, because you can kind of see, you can kind of segment them out in the way scenes happen. And this whole dinner with Kara, like, I don't know where we're going, right? But like, it won't shock me if this, like, this one sticks with me. Like, Cherry Tomato Boys, yes, height of cringe, but also like cringe in a different way where like it felt like it was a little over the top. Here, everything about the start of them sitting at dinner to the ending with the pregnancy reveal is just skin crawling. It like the whole like we'll bring the food to you. It's in Albuquerque. It's an hour. I don't know. Call it Albuquerque. I forget what like the short
Albuquerque. I think
Albuquerque. Like even that. Like we can't go to Albuquerque. Like all of that. Like we got to fatten you up. Like there are so many lines that I delighted in this entire sequence in a way that made me upset. But there are just so many different uncomfortable threads to pull on that I have to imagine this is one of those moments where you were in a ball trying to get through it.
What was great about this is literally every sentence that someone spoke made the situation worse. Like on a sentence by sentence level, every sentence made it worse than it was before they said something. And you just had this feeling that there was nothing that they could say that would be okay.
Just take another big sip of water, yeah. Dave. I just and like the comically large restaurant water, so that like as they're doing, and like now granted everyone has done this,
yes.
Where
you've been
in lull of a conversation, even with people you like quite a bit, where like topic ended, didn't have a natural pivot point, well time to take a sip and hope somebody says something to where we're going next, but like done so in just the like most upsetting way possible.
I think she just kept blundering her way into everything. Like you can't use my, she's calling herself an artist, using Kara's art in staged homes. And then inviting this Pueblo governor person to the art show, which felt very much like, I think Kara's reaction was very much like a kind of tokenism kind of thing. Like if Patrick Klepek said to me, Hey, I invited the other Asian person I know to the podcast, I'd be like, what the fuck, man? that's a weird thing to say.
And I think it also, it goes hand in hand with the confusion she gets over like saying, well, you people are one and the same.
Right.
And so
they're a monolith, you see. So.
Exactly. Like, yeah. and go look it up. Like the thing that the Pueblo leader talks about, like you can, like if you Google the language that he mentions in that sequence, like you can see the actual distinctions that are unique to that area. So they're pulling from like actual stuff in the material they're referencing in the show, and like it just feels hand in hand with that. We're like, look, you already know that like these are not a monolith of people, and then you like try to parlay that into your friend, like no shit, she is like uncomfortable. And in many ways it makes me wonder, and I don't know if Kara is going to be a regular character after this, or this was sort of like a character who's here to move our main characters forward in this episode, but I get no sense of like why they're friends. And especially where we get it to the end of the episode when she tries to go up and talk to what are probably Kara's other art friends, and Whitney's trying to be part of the conversation, and where are we going afterwards, girls, to celebrate? I can't even tell where the overlap is. Like increasingly,
I actually don't sense they're friends. I sense that Whitney is more of a patron than a friend.
That makes some sense.
There is no reason why Kara would be at that dinner unless there is some financial benefit coming to Kara, which like, you know, maybe they, cause she, you know, they say later that they own four of her pieces.
Right.
So right. Maybe her someone at Kara's level, her pieces are probably thousands of dollars each. So like,
right.
They spent thousands of dollars on her work. She's going to take a dinner with them. So I actually don't think they're friends at all. So I'm going to put that out there.
I think that's a good reading of it.
So anyway, also the quote unquote celebration of her being pregnant afterwards is very upsetting, because she's clearly not intending to mention that she's pregnant at that moment. And then when she does, she's clearly not happy about the fact that she has to tell him. And it's an amazing, this whole scene is an amazing performance by Emma Stone. It's like her work is so naturalistic during the whole thing. And she's balancing so many ideas. I'm just really impressed with her.
Really sinks into, now, I think Nathan Fielder is doing a remarkable job of holding his own in the face of like one of our generation's like great actors. Like Emma Stone is just like a top tier actor. And there are times with Fielder where you can like sense he's acting. You know what I mean? Like he's doing a great job, but like he's, you know, it's an unfair fight in terms of like these two, you know, like he's new to this. Like right. he's done a version of a performance in a lot of his work, like outward
yeah,
performance.
Well, let me put it this way, Patrick, you don't know how new he is to this because maybe the entirety of Nathan for You was a performance. We don't know. We don't, who knows what the real Nathan Fielder really is? Is
that's
the
true. So that's true.
So
that's
maybe
true.
His whole life has been a performance. We won't know, but I agree with you. She's incredible. And he's also very good, but I think
yes. he's keeping up. He's yeah, definitely yeah. keeping up, which is, I think there are a lot of people, different actors in the same position that, would not be able to hold their own. And like, it's to his great credit that like, I think he's able to in many of these scenes.
All right. At another equally uncomfortable dinner, Dougie is on a date and reveals a bunch of strategies for getting your blood alcohol content reduced as quickly as possible in order to avoid driving drunk and getting a DUI. he reveals he knows all this because of a drunk driving accident he was involved with. Though he claims being drunk was incidental, because the woman who died was blindsided by another car. He just happened to be drunk when this all happened. My interpretation was that was his like girlfriend or wife that was killed.
I wasn't sure. Yeah, like because you know he awkwardly at the end of the dinner, you know, shows a picture. Like,
yeah,
like it's very clear he's obsessed over this event. Like playing it for laughs, like talking about like ha ha ha, but. I think there's a real sense of a underlying centralized trauma over like what occurred here, or at least is a like defining event in the personal life of Dougie as a person. And yeah, I wasn't sure. I'd believe you if like that prediction like played out, but I didn't necessarily get the sense that, I guess, why would he have a picture of her otherwise? Right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, my sense is he was in the car with her. Mm-hmm. And so it was somebody who was, I don't remember if girlfriend or wife
was T-boned, right? So T-boned meaning like the car's coming like from the other side.
She was in the passenger seat, you know, she gets killed.
Yeah.
So I don't remember if he said girlfriend or wife. It was clearly like a close relation though. It's an amazing scene for a variety of reasons. First of all, it's a very common trope in American society and pop culture that, you go on a date with a guy and he won't stop talking about blank Bitcoin, NFTs, whatever. And it's usually something that's horrifying, you know, like, or that there is no interest to anyone else. And in this case, it's how to avoid getting a DUI, which is like, should be setting off screaming red flags left and right. And then there's this amazing, and you're thinking, oh, this guy is just a caricature of himself. But then there's this amazing moment when she says, you know, because he's trying to say, I happen to be tiny bit drunk, but the car would have hit us anyway because it ran a red light. And, you know, that's, you know, it would have been, I couldn't
that's
have
how
changed
the cookie
anything.
Crumbles.
And then she says, the woman he's on a date with says, hey, do you ever think, like, maybe if you weren't drunk, the car might not have hit you in the first place? And and he says, I actually think about it every day all the time. And it's like, wow, like, there's a lot of weight in that. Yeah. And as you said, he has this kind of like probably obsession with it. And it really does give this character more depth, you know? It's an off screen.
What end? I don't know. Right. Like that's kind of what makes it interesting is for the show to spend this much time. Like it kind of comes out of nowhere. There's not a natural cut to like, what's Dougie up to? You know what I mean? Like it's the show telling us this character is important. There's more to them than just like this douchebag, like Hollywood guy, like who is doing exploitative reality shows. Like that's all true. Like ABC, like that's all part of the character. But to spend this much time seemingly kind of out of context and flow with the rest of the episode, I think is laying important groundwork for where the character is going, where like it's like, you know, Safdie like makes it all work. Like his kind of erratic, like I'm not familiar with Safdie acting. I don't know how adjacent this is to how he is in other roles.
I would say he has shown a significant amount of range based on what I've seen. So
interesting. But I think
this is an atypical character for him. So
gotcha.
That's what I would
gotcha.
Say.
Yeah. Gotcha. But it makes me interested to know, like, why did we need to know this? Like, why did this have to be here? And I'm not questioning it in like a suspicious way as much as it's like, huh, like, what are you going to do with this information going forward?
Let me put this out there. rather than this being some kind of key to unlocking some future plot point, I would probably just say that one of the themes of the show is everyone is carrying some kind of enormous, overwhelming sadness within them at all times.
Mm.
And we certainly know this about Asher and now Dougie. We don't really understand what Whitney's deal is quite yet, other than that she's not a very nice person. So yeah, I think maybe it's just the milieu that the show is operating in versus
that's definitely a plot thing.
So
definitely perhaps true.
But yeah, when they leave the restaurant, Dougie's date wants to take an Uber home, but Dougie offers to drive her. Excruciating scene, because look, if you are that date,
don't do it.
Your date has just told you why they, you know, shouldn't have been held responsible for someone's death because they breathed slightly over the acceptable blood alcohol limit. Do not get in the car. She doesn't want to make things awkward by refusing the ride, but just don't get in the car. This is, by the way, is the most... I don't know if it's the first date that these two are having, but that is the most understanding first date I've ever seen. And or she just has had a string of horrifying men prior to Dougie.
I think there are red flags with this character. Like, her... One thing we didn't really get into in discussing the dinner is, oh, it'd be very natural to assume the person on the other side of this, like the woman in question, like, deeply uncomfortable, doesn't want to engage with any of this. Complete opposite. She's fully engaged in the conversation, thinks some of the information about, like, hey, coffee doesn't really work. Peeing is what... Like she, like, thinks it's funny and interesting and is committed to what this person wants to talk about on the other side of the table. Whereas it'd be very easy to imagine her, like, looking around awkwardly, like sipping into a drink while she's being talked at. And she is being talked at because Dougie has a, I talk to you, we don't engage in a conversation vibe as a character, but she's in it. And so, I mean, we'll get to how this, you know, this, like, this encounter between them concludes, but I think you're onto something. The men in this area or women, whoever the dates that she is going on, have led her to a place where minimal amounts of, like, care, empathy, understanding to another amount to, wow, this might work for
Nailed
me.
It. You're crushing it. Yeah, and so he starts, like, drifting off while he's on the road. He has a portable breathalyzer, and he blows over the limit twice, so then they get out and walk the rest of the time to her house. We don't know how really the day concludes after that. But she does say that she's impressed that he stopped the car after he blew over the limit, because he's like, she's thinking to herself, most guys wouldn't necessarily do that. So, yeah. Anyway.
Hooray.
good for Dougie. Good for Dougie. The bar is on the floor, people. Anyway, back at the casino, Asher's managed to score a meeting with his former boss, where he pitches the casino on overseeing a new project, a kid-friendly arcade in the casino, specifically targeting single parents who are likely to then engage in spending money at the casino. They find the plan intriguing, but they don't have any plans to hire Asher. By the way, couple things to note about that. They were so firm on not hiring Asher, I was wondering, how did that whole relationship end? You know, like, very curious if he soured them in some way. And then also, I just love the idea that this is very Nathan Fielder-esque, right? Is that he comes up with this ridiculous plan and needs to present it to people. That's the premise of Nathan for You.
And that's what, in the intro, that's what I was alluding to, of like, specific arc of this episode that, even in my passing familiarity of Nathan for You, seems like you could just, if this had been in Nathan for You, it would have just slotted into a season of that show.
Yeah. The plan? Entice single parents to go gambling more with a playground at a casino, you know? But I like the idea that he spent a bunch of time writing up this plan just to get into the building. Like, that's the only reason he's there. And you can see him trying all these various ways to stay in the office in incredibly painful and more obvious ways. Like, oh, I got to show you this video. Oh, can I go to the bathroom? Oh, can I? And it's just like, oh my gosh. Then he pulls out the, my wife is pregnant, I got to show you some video of it, to celebrate. And then he pulls up a viral video of a woman slipping on some ice, which, by the way, Classic viral video. Do you know that viral video, by the way, that he showed
her? I 100% have seen it. I actually enjoyed. It's a small thing, like in the grand scheme of what this show is or isn't, will not matter. But I loved that they went and got the rights to an actual viral clip. That if you've been on the internet in the last, it's pretty. This one's pretty old now, like close.
It's like a decade old. And by the way, the clip, if you want to find it, is just Google "woman running on ice" or "woman running on snow," and it's a very famous news clip of a woman being like if there's a blizzard happening. And this woman's out there jogging and she's like, it's actually great to jog in the snow. You know, it's wonderful. She's being interviewed by news. And then she runs off and then slips and like eats it real bad.
I mean, immediately. It's not as like she's in the distance. It's like, well, see ya. Like, thanks for talking to me.
And like 3 seconds later, she's like, boom.
Oh, it's fantastic.
A metaphor for the characters on the show, perhaps, Patrick? Anyway.
Yeah, I can see that.
So the whole sequence is, it plays, the thing is, it's, you kind of know where it is, and it plays out in such excruciating detail and pacing, you know, of, oh, now I'm spilling Gatorade all over myself and on you, and it's just like, oh, it's, and I feel bad for his coworker, because he's probably going to get in trouble after this, you know, it's an exquisite scene, it's an excruciating scene, I loved it, I hated it. Any other thoughts, Patrick Klepek, on this?
Maybe this made more sense to you having watched Nathan for you, but the moment when like he's wiping the floor and it's clear, like, oh, this shit, this isn't going to get him out of the room. This isn't going to give him the clear opportunity to get into the, it's like, well, what is he going to do? And then when he dumps it, I haven't physically reeled too much in this show, but that, and then when he dumps it on himself, like, oh, I did it to me too. Yeah. Like, it's just, it's like, oh, it felt almost improvisational in the way. Again, like, it's one of the things I'm curious.
Well, the character is improvising in that moment, you know. So
the character's improvising, but like, I hopefully now that the like strikes are behind us and people can talk more about like the, I'm very curious like to know how much of this show is like we just did what was on the page and then, you know, yada yada yada, because just some, like in that moment it almost felt like I could have imagined when they shot that scene. Him just dumping that and them just rolling with it. But either way, the resulting scene is horrendously uncomfortable. And it's so much. They got such a big jug of Gatorade or whatever, you know, electrolyte flavor, you know, red flavored drink. It's tremendous. Just like, ugh.
And it really shows off the Nathan Fielder awkwardness that he is, he's well known for. It's so awkward. Everything's so awkward. But anyway. End of the day, Asher successfully gets the files. So in this extremely elaborate cockamamie scheme to like, we are so far afield, Patrick, because the original purpose of this was to prevent the reporter from reporting on his, like, airing that clip of him being angry. And now he's infiltrating his old workplace and like possibly blowing up his old coworker's life.
Episode 2. That seems like if you, the way you described it, I see how we'd get there over the course of a season.
Yeah, it's that's like, that's like the penultimate climax of the season. Yes. Right? No, it's like, no, we're already there, episode 2. Okay, anyway. Asher and Whitney end up at Kara's art show, in which the showcase piece is one where people individually go inside the structure, where Kara is waiting inside, shredding turkey. When Whitney goes in, Kara hands Whitney a plate of turkey, which she begins to eat, only for Kara to scream and be told, "Why did you do that?" Later, Whitney finds the local tribe leader she invited, only to struggle to explain anything of meaning about the art that's surrounding them. The leader is invited to wait in line for the central exhibit, and Whitney betrays the rules of the structure, telling him not to eat the food handed to him. In the structure, the leader doesn't eat the food, and he asks, "Is that it?" to Kara, and then leaves. So, Patrick, did you have any interpretation of what was going on here? I'll share my interpretation.
Yeah, you know? Please elaborate.
I think that if I'm putting my modern art hat on, right, she has people sit inside the structure. She's cutting turkey. She hands people the turkey. People are then compelled to, in a Nathan Fielder-esque situation, people then feel compelled to act. They feel like, well, this person, the turkey was there. I must eat it. Right. And then she says, "Why did you do that?" And it forces you to confront, you know, on a surface level, like, consumption and why like Americans consume on a deeper level, colonialism and like why, you know, why did you rape and pillage the land? Because it was there, you know? That's kind of my basic reading of what was going on there. Right.
Yeah. I feel that it fits within the, we only get to see a couple other objects, like art pieces that Kara's put together as a part of that exhibit. But your interpretation of the structure fits within the other exhibits that we're given glimpses of during our brief tour there.
And I just have to say, I think it works as an art piece. I think like the feel and you know, the feeling it creates when she's saying, why did you do that? Why did you, and you're left at a loss and you're forced to confront those feelings. Now, some people might think it's a little bit too over the top or exaggerated to really work, but I think it works, you know, as a, I'm saying if I went to go see this piece in person, I would be like, oh, that was like a moderately effective performance art. You know, that's kind of what I think.
Well, and it fits with, if you're walking into a gallery and, you know, an exhibit like this, it feels in kind with like the, you know what I mean? Like it's,
yeah,
you know what kind of vibe you're going for. Yes, like these are the kinds of art pieces that are going, the kind of performance pieces that are going to be there. So that may not work for you. You may think it's sort of like goofy and over the top, but like, I think it fits like of a kind with the kind of artist that like Kara is pitched as in the show.
I didn't like the fact, I mean, when I say didn't like, I like how the show is doing most things. I was personally offended at Whitney's violation of the rules. You had one job, Whitney, you know, like don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. She tries to talk with her husband about it. And then she tells she already messed up by inviting that guy, you know, in a way that reeked of tokenism. And then she then messes up his experience of the performance art. I'm like, Whitney. I feel like this is going to come back, by the way, to bite them in some way in a future episode. I feel like that interaction, her, you know, being at the art show, I think it's gonna come back in a bad way. So that's my guess.
I agree. And it's interesting because, you know, you haven't, back when Asher was going to go meet with the reporter privately for the first time, he says, well, come with me. And she says, no, like she doesn't want to be associated with the meeting.
And she's like, this is your story. You know,
this is your story. And like that rings very hollow, like the further we get into, you know, the season. And I think part of what's demonstrated in this episode in particular is not that just Asher, like the pilot spends so much time showing Asher as kind of a bumbling buffoon. Like he's like left to his own devices. Like it's a miracle the man is alive, like at all. And like it kind of sets up, well, maybe Whitney is the together one. Like she's got the rich parent. Like, this is the reason any of this works. And the second episode spends a lot of time poking holes. Like maybe she is the one keeping it together, but it is like, it's a very thin thing that they're holding onto. And Whitney herself is full of holes as a person. And I like the way that they have kind of brought her down to a different level at the end of this. I mean, it's less outwardly excruciating as the dinner scene, but the moment where she tries to explain the art pieces and their significance and basically bounces between like three different things, like, well, you know, this is, you know, like a cultural realm. It's like, fuck the establishment. You know what I mean? Like, cannot land on a single actual thought because the leader's not giving her much to work with. So she just bounces between, what do you want to hear? Like, what's the thing that would make you, like, how do I validate myself through you responding to me? And she can't get any of that. Isn't even rebuffed by one of the folks working the exhibit. Like, maybe you can explain what's going on with these pieces, and like gets nothing out of it.
Well, I think that there's also this idea of her claiming to really support the arts and claiming to be really into the art, but she can't even respect the basic rules that she's been given to this, you know, like her feelings of wanting to know what Asher's experience was in the art or like what she should have done. Those are more important than the art itself. And I think that's going to be a running theme. It was like their feelings are more important than actually doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. It's a really effective entire setup and sequence. So Anyway, what a barrage of just incredibly uncomfortable experiences, Patrick Leffing. So anyway, at the end of the episode, the episode concludes with Asher and Whitney doing a follow-up about Whitney's pregnancy, only for things to get uncomfortable fast. The technician doing the checkups asks if Whitney has had any previous miscarriages, to which she says no, and then asks if she's had any abortions, to which she says yes, but declines to say how many. Asher seems perplexed, and the technician soon reveals the pregnancy isn't viable, but they can try again in 6 weeks. The technician recommends immediately pivoting to a procedure to ensure the unviable pregnancy is taken care of safely, but Whitney is stubbornly insistent on waiting for a Dr. Brown to return. In the car, the two seem shell-shocked for different reasons, but Whitney assures Asher they'll try again and have a baby soon. Asher turns to Whitney and says, "You know you can tell me anything, right?" At which point, Whitney looks away, not answering, as the episode ends. Really great stuff, again. I think the technician is behaving inappropriately, in my opinion. I don't think you should ask details of a person's medical history, even in the presence of that person's spouse, right? Like,
yeah, you don't know how long have they been together,
right?
What has that person shared?
The
other person. I've got two kids. I've been in versions of this room.
Yeah.
Fortunate not to have like gone through as painful a thing as like the two of them are like going through, where you're like informed of a like unviable pregnancy. But like, I assume those questions happen, and they happen between my wife and their doctor, and not, it felt like a reach by the show to do some like plot expediency, which is like, we need to get these elements on the table, and we're going to do it here at the expense of
realism.
A broadly kind of realistic show. And I don't think it's betrayed. It doesn't get into like,
yeah. And look, I'm sure it happens, Pat. You know, I'm sure it happens occasionally where a technician oversteps their bounds. Like that, I'm sure that actually happens in real life, but it does feel weird for this show, in which this couple have experienced virtually every social faux pas possible in the last like 24 hours, you know? So, like, remember the ATM guy? Anyway. Putting the realism of the scene aside.
Sure.
Upsetting stuff. What's going on here? You know, one of the most chilling lines in the episode was when she says to him, "I love how you fight for us." You remember that? "I love how you fight for us." Which is like a very, you know, she's clearly not as into the relationship as he is. She's clearly keeping lots of secrets. He does not share his level of enthusiasm when he says, you know, "I'm going to track you. I'm going to start tracking you. We're going to start having more sex next month." You know, like it's all very painful. Any closing thoughts on this scene, Patrick Leppick, or in the episode as a whole?
No, it makes me wonder if sort of like the card the show is playing at the end here is like, who is this show about? And I think increasingly the evidence is pointing towards like that Whitney is like the primary sort of character that we're going to be unpacking, like as a vehicle to explore a lot of different themes over the course of the season. Maybe that won't be true, and maybe it'll feel more equal between Asher and Whitney as the show goes along. But I find myself much more interested in learning what makes her tick, like what is behind, like much more so than like right now than I am in learning more about Asher, which is not anything wrong with the character, or not that they're I just think there's just so much more going on in Whitney that I am just fascinated to learn, like, how have you arrived at this point? And my guess is the show is going to drag us across concrete to discover the answer to that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of mysteries that the show has set up around the Whitney character. Who was the father of the baby? What are her real feelings about Asher? What is the real deal between her and her relationship with her parents? Like, there's all these like mysteries that you don't know. And I think the show, it does make it very intriguing. I agree with you. She's going to be the character. Like, we're going to hopefully, at the end of the season, be able to go back to the first couple episodes, watch it, and it's all going to lock into place and make sense. That's what we hope. So I'm looking forward to it. And thank you so much for joining us for our journey through this show. You can find more episodes of the podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us. Let us know what you think of The Curse and of this podcast at decodingtv@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your reactions. It's one of the fun things about covering a show like this. So yeah, reach us there. Patrick Klepek, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can follow all my writing and podcasting and streaming about video games at remapradio.com. And you can follow my newsletter about the intersection of gaming and parenting over at crossplay.news.
Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you on the next episode of Decoding TV. Goodbye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.